Hello and welcome. You are watching Lockdown TV. This is the pop-up news and discussion program from Unheard. During these strange and concerning lockdown weeks, we have been trying to bring interesting and brilliant brains to you from around the world to give alternative perspectives on what is actually happening. We've spoken to scientists, thinkers, political people, and today I am delighted that we have a very brilliant person called Professor Michael Levitt. By way of introduction, you are a professor of computer science and structural biology at the University of Stanford, based at the medical school. You were winner of the 2013 Nobel Prize for Chemistry for work on computer models for complex chemical interactions. And since January, you have been taking a close interest in the coronavirus pandemic. So let's just dive straight in, basically. So while the rest of the world and many of us hadn't even really noticed the coronavirus issue, you were already following the numbers very closely coming out of China. Tell us about that.
So basically, my wife is actually a curator of Chinese art. And as a result, we spend quite a lot of time in China. We had been there until the end of November last year, and we have lots of friends there. When the outbreak started in Wuhan, I think I first heard about it on the 20th of January, which was just before the Chinese Spring Festival or New Year. We were very concerned for our friends. We wrote them a kind of consoling message on the Chinese equivalent of Facebook and WhatsApp called WeChat, wishing. And basically, they were very excited to get some news from out of the world. So I then decided that maybe I should use my skills with numbers to look at the numbers. I first compared, and this is probably 25th or 26th of January. By that time, we had about, I would guess, a few thousand cases already, maybe 100 or so deaths. Decided initially just to compare coronavirus to SARS, which we were already scared about. And it was clear that coronavirus was growing much, much faster than. The very first thing I noticed, even before I started looking at the numbers, China actually had two separate outbreaks. In those days, we looked at the numbers from Chinese websites. I can't read Chinese, but numbers are fine. And what we saw is that the outbreak in Hubei province had a much, much higher death rate than the outbreak everywhere else in China, by about a factor of 15. So that was scary. Most of our friends were not in Hubei. They were in Shanghai and Beijing and so on. So the first thing I pointed out is that the death rate in Hubei was about 4 or 5%, whereas outside Hubei it was 1/10 or even 1/15 of that. Then I started to get more into the numbers, and on the 2nd of February, I had been playing with Excel and looked at the numbers and saw that the rate of increase of deaths was slowing down. This is a very easy thing to do. If you take the number of deaths today, the total number, that's basically a 25% increase between 80 and 100. But if the day afterwards, the increase is no longer 25%, it's say 22%, and the day after it's 18%, you start to feel there's breaks have gone on, because for exponential growth, the number should be the same every day. It should be 15%, 15%, 15%, or whatever number it's growing at. So the slowdown of the ratio of today divided by yesterday, either for cases or for deaths, indicates slowing. On the 2nd of February, I noticed that there were 4 days in a row where there'd been a steady linear decrease in the ratio of yesterday, and basically wrote a WeChat message like my wife had done to the same people, our friends, saying that things looked like they were slowing down. We then got on a plane and flew from Israel to New York City. And when I landed, there were all these emails from me saying, "Are you the Michael Levitt who posted this message in Chinese saying that everything is slowing down?" And what had happened is that somebody, I don't even know whom, had taken the 2 pages of PDF that I'd sent them had it translated into Chinese and actually posted it on the Facebook equivalent or the Twitter equivalent in China in Wuxing, and there were already 2 million views of it.
So you then started paying attention every single day thereafter.
So each day, the total number of cases is always increasing, but the number of new cases increases and then gets to a maximum. For an epidemic, it gets to a maximum and then decreases at the same rate. Now, the epidemics, both in China in Hubei and China outside Hubei, and I looked at them, I kept on looking at them separately, both behaved very well. They basically got to their maximum, started slowing down. So it was relatively easy, maybe by the 15th of February, to predict the total death counts for the epidemic inside Hubei, as well as the death epidemic outside Hubei. It was about 3,000 inside Hubei and about 120 outside Hubei. So that was basically how things were. But
so you noticed that the curve was less of a sort of exponential curve than we might have feared in those early days.
In some ways, there was never any exponential growth. From the minute I looked at it, there were never any 2 days that had exactly the same growth rate, and they were getting slower. Of course, you could have non-exponential growth where every single day they're getting more than exponential, but the growth was always sub-exponential. So that's the first step.
So if the, because we talk, at least over here, we talk endlessly about the R rate, the reproduction rate. And apparently that began very high, maybe as high as 3, and now is down, we've got it down below 1 in the UK. Intuitively, if there's a high reproduction rate, you should see that exponential curve just going up and up.
Well, no, wait. Okay, so let's just see this. The R0, which is very popular, is a in some ways, I think, a faulted number. Let me explain why. The rate of growth doesn't depend on R0. It depends on R0 and the time you're infectious. So if you have twice as long infectious and half the R0, you'll get exactly the same growth rate.
Right.
And this is sort of intuitive, but it's not explained. And therefore, it seems to me that I would say at the present time, I think R0 became so important because a lot of movies that were very popular talked about R0. Epidemiologists talk about R0, but looking at all the mathematics, you have to specify the time infectious at the same time to have any meaning. And the other problem is that R0 decreases. We don't know why R0 decreases. It could be social distancing. It could be prior immunity. It could be hidden cases.
You've been observing the shapes of these curves and how the R number tends to come down and the curve tends to flatten in some kind of natural way, regardless of intervention. Is that what you are observing?
We don't know. I think the big test is going to be Sweden. Sweden is practicing a level of social distancing that is keeping children in schools, keeping people at work. They are obviously having more deaths than countries like Israel or Austria that are practicing very, very strict social distancing. But I think it is not a crazy policy. The reason I felt that social distancing was unimportant is that I had the two examples in China to start with, and then we had the additional examples. The first one was South Korea, Iran, and Italy. The beginning of all the epidemics showed us slowing down, and it was very hard for me to believe that those three countries could practice social distancing as well as China. China was amazing, especially outside Hubei, in that they had no additional outbreaks. People left Hubei, were very carefully tracked, had to wear face masks all the time, had to take their temperatures all the time, and there was no further outbreaks. So this did not happen in either in South Korea or in Italy or in Iran. Now, 2 months later, something else suggests that social distancing might not be important, and that is that the total number of deaths we're seeing in New York City, in parts of England, in parts of France, in northern Italy, all seem to stop at about the same fraction of the population. So Are they all practicing equally good social distancing? I don't think so. The problem, I think, is outbreaks occurring in different regions. I think social distancing that stops people moving from London to Manchester is probably a really good idea. My feeling is that in London and in New York City, all the people who got infected all got infected before anybody noticed. There's no way that the infection grew so quickly in New York City without the infection spreading very quickly. So one of the key things is to stop people know that they're sick, infecting others. And here again, China has three very, very important advantages that are not high tech, that don't involve security tracking of telephones. What they involve is, number one, the tradition in China for years of wearing a face mask when you're sick. As soon as the coronavirus started, everybody wore a face mask. It doesn't have to be a hygienic face mask. It just has to be face covering that stops you spraying saliva, micro droplets of saliva on somebody you talk to. The second thing in China is that because of the SARS epidemic, they were so scared of it. In most airports, stations where you pay tolls, etc., there are thermometers, infrared thermometers that measure your temperature. So having your temperature measured at every single store entrance, either with a handheld thermometer or with something mounted on the wall, is something completely standard in China. And the third thing is that almost all payments in China are made not using a credit card. So in some senses, it is very, very much easier there to practice the social distancing. Of course, in addition, they know where people are.
What's your view of the lockdown policy that so many European countries and states in America have introduced?
I think it is a huge mistake. I think we need smart lockdown. If we were to do this again, we would probably insist on face masks, hand sanitizers, and some kind of payment that did not involve touching right from the very beginning. This would slow down new outbreaks. I think for example, they've found, as I understand, that children, even if they're infected, never infect adults. So why do we not have children at school? Why do we not have people working? England is reaching, England, France, Italy, Sweden, Belgium, Holland are all reaching levels of saturation that are going to be very, very close to herd immunity. So basically, and I think that's a good thing. I think the policy of herd immunity is the right policy. I think Britain was on exactly the right track before they were fed wrong numbers, and they made a huge mistake. I see the standout winners as Germany and Sweden. They didn't practice too much lockdown. They got enough people sick to get some herd immunity. The standout losers are countries like Austria, Australia, Israel, that actually had very, very strict lockdown, but didn't have many cases. They have damaged their economies, caused massive social damage, damaged the educational year of their children, but not obtained any herd immunity. I think in many ways, the European countries are fine. They didn't need to have lockdown, but they will have all reached a high enough level of infection not to have to worry about further future attacks of coronavirus. The United States seems to be heading that way. They're certainly that way in New York City, but they still have a long way to go.
What you're saying is that you believe success, as we are currently measuring it, which is as few cases as possible and as small a spread of the virus as possible, is actually failure.
I think if you really control your epidemic, for example, California has now had lockdown for 6 weeks and wants another 4 weeks. They have so far less than 100 deaths. That means they don't have more, let's say, 100,000 in people. That is not enough to give them significant herd immunity. They didn't need to do all that lockdown. The lockdown, I think, is particularly hurtful in countries that don't have good social infrastructure. Countries like the United States and Israel, many, many people have been really, really hurt, especially young people. You know, I think that everybody panicked. They were fed incorrect numbers by epidemiologists. And, you know, this, I think, led to a situation. There's no doubt in my mind that when we come to look back on this, the damage done by lockdown will exceed any saving of lives by a huge factor. One very easy way to see this is that, and again, I'm getting into sensitive territory here, but economists have a very simple way of looking at death. They don't count people. They come to the conclusion that if you're 20 and you die, that's a greater loss than if you're 85 and you die. And it's a hard issue, but in some ways, you know, are we valuing the potential of future life of the 20-year-old? Are we valuing the loss of a more senior person now by what's called DALY, disability adjusted life years? Where basically, if somebody is in their 80s, has Alzheimer's disease, and then dies from pneumonia, perhaps due to corona, that is less of a loss than if a 15-year-old is riding his motorcycle, his bike, and gets run over. So this is an important way of looking at the death. It's also, you know, right now we know that the number of excess deaths in Europe is around 130,000 up till yesterday. This is for all of Europe. This is for a population of around 330 million people. So an excess of 100,000 for this whole year is actually not that much. In some of the worst flu epidemics, we get to those kinds of numbers, sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less. Now, I'm not saying flu is like coronavirus. I'm just simply saying that the burden of death of flu is like coronavirus, especially when we correct for the fact that people who die from coronavirus are older on average than people who die from flu. Flu kills young people. It kills two or three times more people under 65 than does coronavirus. If we put those facts into the situation, we find that the burden of death from coronavirus, I'm fairly sure, will in Europe, where we have good numbers, be less than that of a very, very flu. Another factor which has not been considered are all the cancer patients who aren't being treated, or all the heart cardiology patients who aren't being treated. I've heard estimates of tens of thousands of people who are basically going to be dying because of lack of that treatment. And generally, again, the age group who die of cancer are younger than the age group who die of coronavirus. There's one very easy way to sort of summarize coronavirus. I put an article in the Medium in response to an article by the pretty famous British statistician Sir David Spiegelhalter, Cambridge, and he had said that the numbers coming from Ferguson suggested that we had to lose about 1 year of people. It turns out, in fact, that I immediately wrote an article in the same Medium in reply to him saying that, in fact, the answer was actually 1 month, not 1 year. So basically, my feeling is, and it's being supported by the numbers, that the amount of excess death you need to reach saturation, I'm not going to call it herd immunity, but where the virus by itself stops, is on the order of 4 weeks of excess death. Now, to give you some idea, in the European area where there is good monitoring by a website called Euromomo, which ran out of Denmark, it covers about 300 million people. Every week in Europe, in that area, there's around 50,000 natural deaths. So 4 weeks will be about 200,000 extra deaths in that year. And it looks like coronavirus in Europe, where there is no doubt that it's the most severely hit area in all the world, will probably reach around 200,000 or 4 weeks worth.
So what happens if what you're saying is there's a sort of, there seems to be a statistical observation, which is around 4 weeks of excess death, and then the pandemic seems to peter out or begin to flatten out. What does that mean policy-wise for these European countries then?
So if we could protect the old people perfectly, then the death rates would be very, very low. So, for example, in Europe, I said there were about 140,000 excess deaths in the last, 9 weeks. The number of those excess deaths who are younger than 65 is about 10%. So basically, 13,000 of the 130,000 deaths are actually under 65 years old. So, and if we had simply been able to protect our elderly people, then the death rate would have been much, much less. Remember, the key thing is to have as much infection for as little possible death, and also do whatever you can to keep the hospitals full but not overflowing. It's a difficult calculation. It's one which a country like Sweden can do, where essentially there's no political concerns. The trouble is that in Israel, that I know well, in the United States, everything is political. And therefore, nobody could say something like this. They would say, but you're not valuing death. So the thing that should have been done is for the media to stress to people that every day somebody dies, and these people are essentially in the same age band. You die from corona, have other comorbidities, they have other diseases. I've become a huge fan of Twitter. I'd never used Twitter before. And for me, Twitter is the best discussion forum I have seen since I was a student at the Cambridge Laboratory of Molecular Biology, which is a 26th Nobel Prize winner lab, the best lab in the world. The Twitter discussion is phenomenal. And I'm getting documents from Italy showing that many of the COVID deaths were either dead before they were tested, or else they had up to three other conditions. So this is nothing wrong with this. People die for all sorts of reasons. But the news should be stressing this, and maybe they should be counting it as a 0.1 COVID death. Countries seem to be racing to have as many COVID deaths as they could. And this is a huge mistake. In the flu season, no one cares about these people. I mean, the total number of COVID deaths in Europe will be very similar to a severe flu season. And, you know, this is serious. Flu is a serious disease. But maybe we should just shut down the economy during the flu season. I mean, we need people. People should have been made to understand it. Unfortunately, I think in Britain, they started out wanting to go for herd immunity without too much lockdown. There was then a scary paper, which is likely to be retracted, which influenced Italy as well, where basically it was claimed they would.
Could we just spend a moment on that paper, Professor? Because I know you had some specific queries about Neil Ferguson's paper. We had him
repeat
on the show last week. So what did you think he got wrong in those models and predictions?
So his work was on modeling. In the paper that I saw, and of course these are preprints, initially he found, so I was following China very carefully, and around the 10th of February, he had his first paper that I saw. And in there, he was getting a case fatality ratio of around 15%, whereas all my observations were saying that it was around 3 or 4%. So I was suspicious. I looked at the paper very carefully, and in a footnote to a table, it said, assuming exponential growth for 6 days at 15% a day. Now, I had looked at China and never, ever seen exponential growth that wasn't decaying rapidly, so I was suspicious. My numbers were about 10% less, no, one-tenth, not 10% less, 10% of the numbers that Ferguson had obtained. I basically pointed this out in a reply in the Medium, which is out there, it's clear. Nobody has ever seen it, but it's there, and I didn't hide it. It just didn't get any likes. And this said that it was much more like 1 month than 1 year. And had an exchange both with Spiegelhalter and Ferguson, where I tried to show my case, basically saying that all I was doing was just simple proportionality, using exactly the same profile of different ages have different death rates. So there's a profile saying that people over 80 have a certain fraction of the deaths, people between 70 and 80 have a different fraction. Just using that data from almost anywhere. It could be South Korea, it could be Wuhan, it could be anywhere. And just simply saying, we want the number of deaths that occurred on the Diamond Princess to be the same number that we found, which was 7 or 8. If you do that, and then you apply that proportionality to Britain and the USA, you find that for Britain, the 500,000 drops to about 50,000, and in the United States, the 2 million drops to 200,000, essentially a year dropping to a month.
So the argument that is made here is that whether you believe the infection fatality rate is 0.3% or whether you believe it's 0.8%, there is still a big chunk of the population, the majority of the population, who hasn't had been exposed to the disease or hasn't had it. And therefore, if we just let it rip, there will be many, many tens, possibly even further hundreds, according to Professor Ferguson, of thousands of deaths. And that's why it's politically totally not an option to do anything other than follow this ultra-cautious approach. I mean, what do you say to that?
What I say is that the World Health Organization, and I think epidemiologists in general, can only go wrong if they give a number that's smaller. If I said there's going to be 1 billion deaths from coronavirus, and then say, oh, sorry, you guys have done what I've said, there's only going to be 100,000, that is considered good policy. They overestimated bird flu by a factor of 100 or 10,000. There was a paper in The Guardian. The Guardian wrote about this. Ebola was overestimated by a factor of 100. I think they say their role as scaring the people into doing something. I can understand that, and there's something to be said for it. If you could practice lockdown with zero economic cost and zero social cost, let's do it. But the trouble is that those costs are huge. We're going to have fatalities from hospitals being closed down. We're going to have additional children in trauma. We're going to have businesses damaged, maybe less so in the UK because of the compensation policy, but certainly massive economic damage in the USA and in Israel and in other countries. So you need to balance both of these things. And, you know, it seems to me that, you know, that's what I don't think is responsible. In my work, if I say a number is too small and I'm wrong, or a number is too big and I'm wrong, both of those errors are the same. If I'm 10% too high or 10% too low, that is okay. It seems that being a factor of 1,000 too high is perfectly okay in epidemiology, but being a factor of 3 too low is too low.
I'm trying to think about what this means for the UK and for these countries that are trying to work out what to do next. Is your view then, having looked at the numbers, that if we had not implemented lockdown, we would have seen a fall off anyway? Is that a fair summary?
We could have had smart lockdown. Sweden, for example, doesn't allow gatherings of more than 50 people. I think a football game would be a really bad idea right now because people shout and therefore spray saliva on everyone around them and they could infect a lot of people. But, you know, Sweden is doing fine. And their deaths, again, are very localized to nursing homes like they are in England. It's the same profile. I think that, you know, again, if Sweden... So all the evidence suggests that... So my prediction is the following. Britain, if they had done nothing, would have had reported deaths. Not... Remember, there's a difference of reported death. My numbers are all reported deaths. We'd have 4 weeks of additional reported death. When the numbers actually came in from what were the real excess deaths, my guess is they would be less than that. So it would not have been double what there was in the month, but maybe 1.75 or so on. So that is my feeling. We're seeing this in Europe. We will know the answer in 3 or 4 weeks' time. We will know for all of Europe exactly what the excess death of coronavirus was. Right now, it's 137,000.
Do you find, when you've been making these points on Medium or in the media, that you received a lot of backlash? Do you think there's a lot of political pressure? And as an academic, You know, that one of your colleagues in Stanford, Dr. Yanoudias, has also put out studies that seem to become skeptical and has received a lot of political blowback. I just wonder whether you've experienced any of that.
I went on CNN once, but it was CNN, Becky Anderson out of London. I appeared on Fox News a couple of times, basically said, this is all just common sense. Because I appeared on Fox News, CNN wouldn't have me anymore. So basically, I have said very clear things. I had one article in the Los Angeles Times, which did great. But since I was not saying things that were too extreme, none of the East Coast newspapers wanted me. They quoted me, but they wouldn't have me. What was disconcerting is a few of my academic colleagues, even relatives, were very upset with me. Because in my earlier writings, I published a report that was, well, it was the Medium report from the 22nd of March, but on the 14th or 13th of March, I distributed a 19-page report. Three academics got very upset with me. I think they were totally panicked, and they felt that if anyone thought this was true, they wouldn't lock down as tightly as they should. I'm in fact friends with all the people again. There are no hard feelings.
Let me leave you with one final question. What's your prognosis? What do you think is now going to happen with this? I mean, do you think we're now, what happens next?
There will be a reckoning. Maybe countries will start to see that they need governments that are not necessarily great in rhetoric, but actually thinking and doing things. I often go back and think about what Socrates said 2,400 years ago. Use your common sense instead of listening to the rhetoric of leaders. And we've become very influenced by that. I think also what should happen, and this is going to sound very strange to you, I think this is another foul-up on the part of the baby boomers. I am a real baby boomer. I was born in 1947. I'm almost 73 years old. But I think we've really screwed up. We caused pollution. We allowed the world's population to increase threefold in my lifetime, even more. We've caused the problems of global warming, and now we've left your generation with a real mess in order to save a really small number of very old people. If I was a young person now, I would say, now you guys are going to pay for this. We have a family WhatsApp, and very early on I said, this is a virus been designed to get rid of the baby boomers. You know, I don't know. I think my wife thinks this is going to be a sea change, and there are going to be young people in the street saying, you guys have really screwed up. It's time to go. And I always joke with her and saying, well, at least I've made lots of friends among the young people. I'll be okay. But quite frankly, you know, I've had a great life, and I'd much rather see young faces in front of me. I have a grandson who's 17. I'd much rather have young people than live for a very long time. That said, I do have a mother who's 105 years old, living in London with my brother. She's in lockdown, and I talk to her by WhatsApp every single day or on FaceTime, and she's fine. She still uses her phone and so on. So, you know, there's differences. But you guys should get out there and do something. Don't accept this anymore. We screwed it up too much.
Professor, thank you so very much for your time.
My pleasure.
That was Professor Michael Levitt of the University of Stanford. Thanks to him and also his 105-year-old mother. We sincerely hope she is doing well here in London. He is the Professor of Structural Biology and Computer Science at Stanford. He was the recipient of the 2013 Nobel Prize for Chemistry, and he was sharing there some of his views, looking at things from a bit of a different angle, more of a numbers angle than a straightforward epidemiology angle. And here at Unheard, we want to get these different opinions and try and allow you to make your own mind up. So thank you to him. We will be back next with Professor Heinrich Streeck of the University of Bonn, who has just completed the first fully detailed study of seroprevalence, or that is immunity to the coronavirus, and he will be sharing the findings with us on Monday. So we look forward to that.